Yeah, I make games, and I'm your host, Mizzes, with co-hosts Brogan Hackett and Adam Pipe. And this week, we're joined by Jabrils. So, Jabrils, what do you do?
I make YouTube videos, first and foremost, game dev second. I'm still trying to figure out my pitch.
Thank you to our anonymous donor for sponsoring this episode. If you'd like to sponsor an episode, DM me on Twitter. You started as like a tech YouTuber, kind of, and then you got into game dev, and then also machine learning, and then also animation, and all that stuff. Like a bunch of things.
Yeah, so I got started originally as a game developer. I started making Game Maker games a while back, and then I learned that you can use this thing called Unity to make games. And then that just opened me up to the whole world of like all those various things that you can do with the knowledge that you learn when you do like 3D coding. So then I downloaded Python and started doing like Python apps. And then machine learning became really big, you know, like machine learning libraries like TensorFlow and whatnot, and started playing with that. Next thing I know, I was just, everyone see me as this guy that like does machine learning. I was like, okay, I guess I'll roll with this. But like I've always had a passion for like basically everything, which is a problem. Because it's hard to define exactly what I do. So like now I'm playing with like make animated series, and I'm trying to launch a little console project. And long story short, it's a mess.
Listen, I only do game dev, and sometimes I feel like I'm doing everything. So I can't imagine how bad it's for you.
So there's been like this tweet like making the rounds lately of this guy who has to turn down a publisher contract for like $500,000.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you saw it, but it's like, and then he went over like the stipulations and like what's in the contract and stuff, and it's like super crazy. Like he had to like at breach of contract, like they could keep making the game and he had to pay for it or something. It was really crazy.
Yeah,
I saw that.
Yeah, and it's like, it's stuff like that that makes you just like scared of working with a publisher, you know? I was like, for a sec, like, wait, is my publisher contract good? You know, what am I doing? Oh my God. So I guess my question is like, do you want to get a publisher for your game? And like, when you do, or if you do, like, what's like the make or break stipulation for you?
Yeah, you know, I think that for me, if I were to get a publisher, I would be looking at it as like a partner, right? Mm. More so than the exposure. It's like, what can you provide to help? I guess it would, in this case, be our game do better. And if I can't get like a satisfying answer on how they can help our game do better, then I don't see a reason to go with them. I'd rather, you know, just figure out how to market it myself in various ways. Mm.
That's like totally right. The publisher does have to put in whatever amount of money split they're getting. They have to put in basically that much effort into making sure the game does as well. But the thing is also that a lot of indie devs can't afford to or don't have the ability to do solo dev on their own for years or anything like that. So sometimes it's a matter of needing money to be able to actually make a game. And I think that's when compromises get made. Personally, the biggest thing I think, if I were working with a publisher, would be ownership of the IP and some degree of ownership over end product as well. But like there's so many complicated legal things around that so many different clauses and stuff that could impact that. That it's never going to be clear cut who owns what.
I used to really want a publisher just so like, because it was like, I want to make games and I don't want to, I don't want to have to like worry about money and stuff just, or marketing, just make the game and that's it. So if I had a publisher, it'd be great because they'd take care of all those things. But now it's like, I don't really want a publisher because I don't see I have money. I have the following. I don't need those things anymore. And the only reason I could think of to get a publisher would be if they're going to like help me port it to consoles or something. It's like, okay, if you want to publish my game on consoles, I'll do that. Otherwise, I just don't see the point in them taking a cut of my money. And then also, I did have a weird experience with a publisher like in college. The CEO reached out to me and like called me and was like, thought my game was great and wanted to publish it. And he sent like this incomplete contract. And he's like, yeah, we'll figure out the details later. Just sign it and send it back. And I was like looking over the contract and I'm like, okay, it seems okay, you know? But I just in case I wanted to get somebody who actually knew contracts to like read over it. So I got like a family friend who was an intellectual property lawyer.
Mm.
And he looked over and he pointed out like a bunch of little things I'd missed that were kind of a little bit scummy, and like that they would have the rights to any sequels I made. They would have all rights to the game. Yeah, all rights to the game and any sequel for like the next 10 years. And then it would auto renew for another 10 years. And it was like, I don't know, there's all these little things in there. And like I reached back and I was like, hey, could we, you know, maybe modify this so it's like not auto renewing, and like some other things that I hadn't noticed. And they just never responded for like months until I was like, hey, I'm going to find another publisher. And then they finally did respond, and they just never like brought up the contract. And like when I finished the game, he was just like, yeah, we're restructuring the company. We actually can't really give your game the attention it deserves anymore. And it was just like, what? Like it was so, it was like they were super enthusiastic about getting my game and like signing me and everything until I like, the moment I mentioned I was getting a lawyer to look at the contract, they like immediately like started being hesitant. And the thing is, this is one of the top indie publishers. Like I see them all the time. They're always, every time you see like a GDQ or whatever, their logo is right there. Like they're one of the top sponsors on everything. Like they're one of the biggest names. And I just remember this like sketchy ass experience I had with them. And I'm just like, really? Like,
yeah. See, this is the issue that I have with like indie developers being desperate, is because then the power dynamic shifts into the hands of like corporate greedy individuals.
Yeah.
Where they're like, oh, Miz, you don't want to sign your game off for basically nothing. Don't worry, we'll find another developer who's willing to do that. And
yeah,
that's where I come back and I'm like, well, what are you offering, right? Because if you're not offering anything of value, then no, there's no point in me taking this deal. And I do understand your point, though, about needing money. I guess my question is, as I said, I'm a YouTube creator first, game developer second. At what part of the process do most people seek publishing deals?
From what I've seen, people either seek it in the pre-production stage when they basically have a pitch and a design document roughly outlined, or they seek it once they have a prototype. I've seen some cases where games get picked up when like you've seen them in development, say on Twitter for a few months, and they posted a bunch of GIFs that have gotten good responses.
Yeah.
I've seen that more a lot more recently.
I've also seen cases of developers like almost being done with their game and then just needing a publisher to like just publish.
And that includes like marketing, I assume.
Yeah, and usually like the deals are more because they're not really asking for funding at that point. Like they're able to get right. A better deal.
Interesting.
I wanted to say that like basically right now I am looking to publish a game or to get a project published and funded, but it's hard. Like it's scary thinking about entering a deal that could be like 2 years of your life working on something.
Mm-hmm.
And how many horror stories there are out there. So I'm hoping whatever ends up happening, it goes well. More on that in a future episode probably.
Yeah, I hope so. But yeah, it's interesting that what you said, Miz, about like it being like a huge publisher and they treating you like shit. I feel like maybe that's probably the reason, you know. I think like the biggest publishers, they have so many like people and like contracts and stuff in their portfolio. They just treat everyone like shit, probably.
Yeah. I think some of the bigger indie publishers seem to just be throwing spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's Tiny Build gets one sort. They had like an article where they were getting like 50 million investor funding, and then it's just like, okay, we're just going to try and get like 50 games on this year, and one of them is going to be a success, and all the rest will just abandon. You know.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, I read that.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I guess that's kind of scummy. But, yeah, I've also had, like, a really bad experience with, like, a publisher. Also, where they, you know, they had, like, a contract and they sent it to me. And, like, the contract was just like, oh, yeah, we'll own the IP. And then we were like, I don't know, is owning the IP, is that a common place? Because we were, like, idiots and we didn't know. And we asked them and they were like, yeah, yeah, it happens all the time. This is, like, standard practice, you know. And so we were, like, almost ready to sign, actually. But then I talked with one of the people that used to do business with them, like the who made a game that was published by them, but like the one of their earlier games, and even like early days, they were like pretty much assholes and they didn't really do anything. And when I told him about like the fact they were like chasing IPs, he was like, "Oh my god, they're doing that now? Well, now they're really assholes." So that is definitely, yeah, for me, that's like the worst, I think, the only IP. And I'm happy I never signed the contract, I guess.
One thing I'll say to any desperate devs out there, something that I heard after I lost that contract, I was like really bummed out. I was in college. I was like, damn, I missed my chance to be a millionaire before I graduate. And I talked to my uncle, who's like a really good business person. And he was just like, you know, you missed an opportunity, but there's always going to be more opportunities, so just now you'll be better prepared for the next one. Yeah. And he was right, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
just take the good ones, not the bad.
Yeah,
ones.
Exactly. And yeah. I think selling your IP, it does happen sometimes, and that's like I think the reason why a lot of publishers do say that sometimes it is kind of common practice. But I think when it happens, it's like an established IP, and it's like, you get like 50 million just for the IP, you know. So if you're not getting 50 million for your IP, just don't sign the contract, I guess.
So coming off the last question, the most appropriate question to follow up is, do you think that game developers should try other computer science fields? And I ask this question because I seen a tweet, I think it was a couple months ago, of a game developer who changed fields. They went to go work at SpaceX, I believe it was, and they made a tweet talking about how they were surprised at how well they were able to adapt to like learning how to code for SpaceX, even though they used to do game dev. And then their manager basically shared a quote or something like, "It's a shame that most programmers will only ever do game dev like all their life." And I thought that was fascinating.
That's really good. That's a good point about the programming. I think it's mostly because most people who get into game dev, they kind of go into it for the fantasy, and then like for them, like they don't want to be called a programmer. I still don't want to be called a programmer. So it's kind of like a weird pride thing, I would guess.
Yeah.
But I'm in like Discords with this one game developer, and he works at Microsoft now. I once like asked him like, "Hey, why did you like stop doing games and why are you at Microsoft?" And he said, "I stopped doing games and now I'm doing money." So,
so I actually have because I've been making games since I was 17. But when I went to college, I went and studied software development, which, despite what my parents claimed, is very different to game development. I knew that at the time as well, sort of, but. There's a lot that I didn't like about it, because I'm a creatively driven person, and working in something where what you're actually doing is so set in stone and there's no room for creativity a lot of the time, it's personally, it's very draining. And that's why I really want to be able to work on my own games and hopefully find a studio or something. I tried to work as a software developer after college as well, and it just like, I couldn't stand it. Even like the software I was working on was related to game development, and it was just I need to be making games to like feel whole, I guess, in a weird way. Or I need to be making art of some kind anyway.
I'm a big fan of John Carmack and his like tech work. Just like, I mean, the graphic stuff he did in the early 90s or in the 90s and 2000s was like insane. And like, and then he switched to rockets, and then he switched to VR, and then he switched to AI now. And it's just like, you know, like I definitely like that kind of high tech stuff, and I'm fascinated by algorithms. But it's just like, I always feel like the high, you know, like the cutting edge, you know, stuff is no longer easy to, is no longer plausible or feasible to pursue as like a solo developer or solo person. In like all the fields that I would be interested in, like graphics or something. Like I feel like for me to do like research in real time computer graphics would be like pushing at like the smallest niche of the smallest niche.
Yeah.
Like I look at the graphic innovations being done now, and it's like, hey, look, Unreal, it has real time bounce lighting on reflective surfaces, and you can And you can just barely make out that that's happening if you spend about 10 seconds analyzing this image, comparing it to the previous version. It's just like, it's not the same as like going from like Wolfenstein to Doom to Quake, you know, it's like with these big jumps and it's like super impressive. And it's like one person did that or something, you know, it just feels like, yeah, there's not as much glory and there's not as much like stuff you can do alone. And it's not going to make as much of a difference.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, Miz, because I'd be similar. I'm very interested in graphics programming. And the way I'd put it is that I'll watch 100 SIGGRAPH talks, but I'll never do one.
Yeah, I know. I kind of want to push back on that a bit, because the argument that like modern day graphics research is not the same or not comparable to like earlier day graphics research, I think it's not true, right? Because if you look at some of the research that Pixar had to do, for example, on Toy Story, right, they had to research on how to make like specular models, for example. Like today you just open up Blender and you just like do a specular slider, but they had to research how to do this, and it took like a team of people to do, right? I understand the point, but I do think at the same time that it's all relative to the age that you're in.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and probably 10 years from now, I'll be looking back at something and be like, whoa, I could have been working on this.
Right.
That would have been cool. I could have been right there at the start.
I think there is still room for doing experimental graphics programming, for example, as a solo dev, but you kind of have to, throw away the idea of representing realistic physical light interactions and move towards stylizing. Mm-hmm. Because the thing I always think about art direction is that a stylized game ages 1,000 times better than a game that aims to be realistic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's still so much room for stylization. There's so many art styles out there that haven't actually been represented in games. So I mean, there's definitely room to do something interesting, but it's not going to be very useful for other people.
Perhaps. I know that Sebastian Legge, he's done some graphics research recently in some of his videos. Calculations on geometry. It's applied to games, and it's you know, basically it's kind of cutting edge. Like, it's not easy for you to get into. You have to do some research yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible to do.
Yeah, he's been working with compute shaders, I think, which is
there it is. Yes. That
I've been very curious to try out at some point. But it's also very scary.
Yeah.
But if I ever end up making like a procedural generation game, which I really want to do, I'm definitely going to try and use some compute shaders for that.
What I've noticed, the best area kind of that I'm interested in that I think like could break new ground and do some real innovation would be related to VR. Because there's just not like a whole lot going on there. And I think it's like a lot of people are still kind of trying to do or just port PC games to VR mostly, mm-hmm. like first-person shooters and just kind of, you know, that kind of thing. And I feel like there's a lot of potential for interesting things you can do in VR that would actually be fun, that could be done, actual innovation that could be done, both on the design side, but also on the hardware side for, like, just a solo person. Like, yeah, I mean, I've had ideas for VR hardware I could make that I think could be interesting and be fun to experiment with.
What do you think about like the Quest opening up like the API for the AR stuff?
Wait, they're opening it up?
Yeah, they're opening it up so you can like try it out and stuff, from what I know.
Oh, just the AR though, not the...
No, just AR stuff.
It's not actually open source.
Oh, no.
I'm skeptical about Oculus AR. I don't know. I think like looking at real life through goggles, I feel like that would be strange. I've tried the Magic Leap, which is like the best AR on the planet. I don't know if they're still going or not, but all it is right there is just a film. Like, they just have a film and then it's overlaid onto reality. I can't imagine like having your eyes covered. Has anyone tried it before?
You have like the Sifu thing on Quest, but it is like pretty weird. But I don't know. I feel like... Yeah,
it's very low frame rate. Yeah,
looking for reality like through goggles, I feel like at least like the frame rate of reality and like whatever app you're making matches up, and maybe that makes it less nauseous. I don't know. I've never tried AR, so I don't know if it is nauseous. You can do more stuff with it, I think.
Yeah, I haven't done anything besides, I guess the only AR I've done is on the Quest when you draw the outline and it like shows the dots overlaid over the real world.
Also, to answer like your original question with other fields, Not really computer science field, but I think it would be cool to try like game development stuff for like non-game development stuff, you know, like how they're using like Unreal to do like movies and stuff, and you know, stuff like that. That does interest me. I have like this idea of starting a company one day that does like certain machines, but they're like really juicy and they're made in Unity, you know. I think that would be cool. Just doing like very like polished like user experience for like random stuff, you know, like soda machines.
Just go to a vending machine to get a soda. It's like, what would you like to buy? And you press the button and it like blinks and, you know, makes all the particle effects and good sound effects.
There's actually, you're actually standing on a little platform in front of the soda machine and that shakes to emulate screen shake.
That would be good.
What area of games do you think machine learning has the most potential for? I ask this obviously because I know Jabril's has done quite a bit with machine learning, and I think it's definitely got applications in games, and I'm curious to hear what everyone thinks.
I love this question a lot because my answer has evolved over the years as I experiment more with it. And I personally think the best application for machine learning in games is like anytime you need to classify something. I personally believe that this is the best, but the issue is that like it's kind of behind the scenes, so it's kind of hard to identify like, oh, this is machine learning. Out of all the experiments that I've done classifying like various states, or you know, maybe what is classification, it's a very broad like stroke, but I think classification is definitely the best.
That's interesting because it's actually something, or it's at least related to something I considered trying to do a project on for one of my college projects, which was going to be basically applying machine learning to player metrics of where players like visit, and then using the results out of that to determine when the most effective point in like say a horror game would be to do something scary, or where players look the least that we can put something interesting, or like to inform what players find boring in say level design. I never did it, but it seems like a good application to augment the development process as opposed to actually exist within the game.
Have you seen the GitHub pilot thing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Or like the Visual Suit by that's crazy to me.
Very controversial.
Yeah. I'm sure there'll be something like that gets it right eventually, but it seems to have not quite been doing as well as they'd hoped.
Yeah, we need evolution of machine learning tech before like we can improve the accuracy of these models. Because the current techniques that we're using, it's not going to do it. Like, we've basically hit the ceiling. Until someone comes out like, oh, I found this new way to, you know, process data, then we can get there. But because there's just a huge lack of understanding of the data with the current method that we use. You know, there's like a lot of guesswork, and it can only make connections so deep before it's like, okay, I throw my hands up. I don't know.
That's interesting that you said that, because my answer to the question is like, I have like this idea of something I want to do, but I'm like 90% sure that I just don't know how machine learning works. And that's probably why nobody has tried it before.
Yeah.
But like my idea was like, I feel like maybe doing like making enemies that kind of react to like your level of proficiency with a game. Because like, you know how like machine learning kind of like learns from stuff. Like, what if it could learn from you, you know?
Yeah.
That's like my idea, you know, like an FPS game and the enemy would learn from like you, the way you play or something. But I don't know if that's practical. But
That's sort of similar to what I was saying about like analyzing what the player does.
Mm-hmm.
And how the player reacts to certain things. That was like also part of it was to suggest AI stuff that could be done.
Also, I just want to throw this out here. So many people, like, just in my experience, like, always point to machine learning as like this end all be all thing.
Yeah.
The examples that you guys provided that you want to apply machine learning to, just note that like you don't have to use machine learning. Like, you can easily accomplish this without machine learning as well.
That's true as well.
Yeah.
And machine learning definitely has downsides, like the whole black box thing and everything.
Mm.
Yeah.
you definitely need to know if what you're using it on is actually a good application, or if you just think it's a good application.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I've always been impressed by when I see like machine learning videos, is just how little anybody understands it. They just like make this thing and they're like, well, that didn't work. Let me try changing these things. Well, that didn't work. Yeah. Oh, this one worked, but I don't know if it's working because it's actually working or if it just memorized everything. So it's just, you know, and it would just be like...
I definitely think like there has to be some point in the process of developing machine learning technology where they come up with a better way to debug it. I'm certain there are things that they have already. But from what I know, there's definitely a lacking in like actually user readable output of what's actually going on behind the scenes.
I guess that's kind of where the Google Dream or whatever was Deep Dream View thing came from, was just them debugging, trying to debug what like the image recognition algorithm was seeing.
Yeah,
Cosmic Horror View.
That actually brings up the other thing I really want to see machine learning applied to, which is just visuals in general. Because
oh yeah,
I mean, machine learning visuals are so cool. But to get like a temporarily coherent visuals out of machine learning is so difficult. But I saw recently some really cool videos on
the GTA one.
Yeah, on the 2 Minute Papers channel, there was a Minecraft one and a GTA one, and those both look really cool. I don't know if I'd personally be applying it as a photorealism thing. More that I would probably like, what I'd love to do is like hire an artist to say get the block out of this like low poly block out of a level, and then add in their details as they see fit at like a few set views over the course of like a few years. Have a whole art team doing stylistically coherent art based on the actual level design of a level, and then run that through and make the machine learning output that. But I don't know if that would be like more efficient or less efficient than actually just manually like doing the graphics programming to make a game look like the art output.
Well, it all has trade-offs, right?
Yeah.
Like I went to, I think it was GDC a couple years ago before COVID, and Google had a setup where they had a bunch of demos on display. This is right before they announced Stadia. And one of the demos they had, it was a machine learning, the style transfer. They had a style transfer running real time on a game in which you can just swap out which style you want to overlay. And, you know, a couple of them were like, oh, this is pretty cool. But overall, it was, you know, it's kind of like what's going on here. But the trade-off, right, is that you don't get to control what any frame looks like, right? So
yeah.
Someone takes a screen grab and it's like, oh, I hope it looks good.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's what reminds me of what I think the most practical use of machine learning right now in games is just upscaling old games. Like you see, what's it like, Final Fantasy IX. I think if you look for like a remaster, the best you're going to get is there's the official one, which has all the textures are just upscaled with like a bilinear filter. So it's just blurry. And then they have better 3D models. So the fans went in, took all the images from the old game and ran them through some, you know, AI upscaling filter. And like, it looks way better. I mean, it's not perfect. It doesn't look hand drawn, but it's, you know, it's a lot better than the alternative, which was, yeah. Either super pixelated or super blurry. But yeah, I think that's just upscaling old games is kind of the best use of machine learning right now.
Fair enough. I would agree with that argument. I think your answer actually might override mine, actually, because you can create state machines like without machine learning, but upscaling images without it is probably a really daunting task. So I have a question. It's kind of an observation, but also a question. Is YouTube the key to monetizing like indie game developers these days? And I say this because I guess like when I started YouTube, one of the channels that I watched on YouTube was Thin Matrix. And his whole thing was like he was developing a game, but also making a devlog for it, but also running ads and making money off of the process, like making a devlog.
Yeah.
And this has become really popular these days. You know, you have like Thomas Brush, Kindred Games, Jones, even you, Miz, I would argue, who are like making videos but also making a game to ship behind the scenes, versus, you know, not having an outlet or rather not having a way to make like extra money. So my question is like, is this the key to monetizing any game devs these days, or what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's the most reliable way to do it. From what I've seen, the people who've like being able to achieve financial success with the least amount of like luck involved were doing some kind of like consistent, you know, promoting themselves by creating content on like, you know, usually YouTube. But there's also I was at a game convention a few weeks ago, and I met a few people who were, they use TikTok, like really successfully promoted their games on TikTok. And I went and I looked on TikTok, and I found a bunch of game developers who are just like posting clips of their games, getting tons of views. Mm. And it's like, it was really interesting because like by the standards of like YouTube game dev today, I was like seeing, it looked a lot like, it reminded me a lot of YouTube game dev 3 years ago. Like the quality is not as high as today, but it didn't matter. Mm. It was still getting tons of views. Like there's this one video somebody had just showed, we changed our jump animation, and it was just like this small change, and it had like, I think like over 100,000 views, just like of like a 20-second clip of a new jump animation. Like, what? This is crazy. Like that's all it takes right now. But yeah, I think if you're doing something consistent and steady, that's going to like build a following and you can monetize it, that's like your best bet. Even on Twitter, I know I know the people who run the Wholesome Games Twitter page. Mm. Like right when they were starting it out, they used to run the game dev scene where I used to live, or I guess they still run it probably. But yeah, and like, and they were working on a Wholesome game. They're like, this seemed like a good way to promote our game, right? We can build a following of people interested in these kinds of games, and then we can, you know, shout out our own game on there, and then, you know, that's a good reliable way to get sales.
Control the media.
Yeah. Control the media. Exactly. You control the media, and then you can guarantee yourself sales.
Yeah, too. But I don't know. Wouldn't you argue that doing the whole YouTube thing is like doubling the amount of work?
I was about to say that because I've been wanting to make YouTube videos for a while. I mean, I used to want to make like Let's Plays of Minecraft when I was a teenager, obviously. But like since I guess I made my show reel in 2018, I've been like, oh, I want to make some devlogs. And then the same after I did the 4devs video with Miz, I was like, oh, I'll post some more in-depth video on my game. And then I just started new game dev projects instead of making videos on the ones I was doing. And I've even written up like scripts for videos and stuff and just never made them. But I don't know, maybe I'll do it eventually. So yeah, what you're saying about it being like a consistent source of income and like something that's a little bit more reliable is very true. But as Adam said, it's also a lot more work. And like, especially if you haven't made videos before, and you personally, I hold myself to a certain standard with my game dev, and not holding myself to that standard if I was making YouTube would be very hard. So I have higher expectations of myself going into YouTube than I did going into game dev like 8 years ago.
Yeah, you have to learn a whole new set of skills. And yeah, it's like starting over again. It's something new.
Yeah, and wouldn't you also argue that you kind of have to make games that kind of work as content for YouTube?
No, I wouldn't argue that. I think there are channels that they just work on a game, they do devlogs, and they know that they're not going to make millions and millions of views, but they're going to cultivate like a really core audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've always thought that if I want to do like the game of the month thing full time, then maybe starting like a YouTube with that would make sense. Because I feel like maybe having like the monthly different game thing would also work for the monthly different video thing.
I've seen a lot of variety of games like get good or lots of views on videos about them. Like somebody did a tabletop game, and that got a ton of views, and it was just like good thumbnail, you know, good title. That was all it really took.
Yeah.
I feel like there's fans of every kind of game, and they're all going to be interested in seeing the behind the scenes.
I want to follow up real quick with Miz. So my understanding is like, if you don't have some alternative way to fund, you know, as you develop your game over the like a couple years, the only other alternative is a publisher, right? So Miz, has how has YouTube changed your perspective on like publishing deals?
Well, now it's just like, again, you know, what's the point? It's just like, I'm doing all that stuff myself. Like, why should I have somebody come in and take all my profit when they're not giving me anything? And like, and even at this point, it's now it's just like, why should I even get a publisher to like publish my game on other platforms? I could just pay somebody to convert it and do all the work for me, and then I don't have to give them royalties.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah, I'm now in the position of power, and it's just like, they don't have anything to offer me, so it's like, what's the point, you know?
Speaking of that, do you have like plans for like QA stuff? Are you like gonna hire your own QA people, or are you just...
Oh, that's called Patreon. People pay me $5 a month to play test my game.
Oh my god!
It works great, actually. Like, it's really great. People pay me to play test my game, and you know what's great is that I can like, as I tell people, I'm like, by the way, you know, I don't charge up front, so you could just download the game, you know, and as long as you cancel before the, you know, end of the month, you won't get charged. And it's like, wow. So people are like, wow, you're so great. People can still play it for free even if they can't afford it. And I'm like, that's right. You're giving me free play testing.
In one way, that's good, but there are definitely advantages that come from dedicated playtesters that I presume you're missing out on there, because like, No one's going to test the exact same interaction 10 times with different variations to like in your Patreon, you know, and no one's going to like go through a checklist of these things work perfectly.
Yeah,
that's true, because like the QA we're getting with like DreadXP has been really, really great and like super organized. And it's really also just great to have people that are constantly replaying your game, you know? And you're not going to get that, I think, unless you have like some absolutely crazy fans, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, you just need like three, you know, crazy fans. I feel like you could get to that point.
Oh, you could make like a spreadsheet of all the bugs in your game. And then like if a user like catches it and fixes it, it, you know, like tells you that it's fixed, they get like Patreon points or something. I don't know.
Probably. I mean, my plan is just when I get close to release, then it's just like, okay, everyone, find every single thing wrong with my game and tell me, and then I'll probably get like a flood of like every slight nuanced thing that's causing issues. And also the thing about continuously putting out videos about it and promoting it is that I keep getting new people coming in who will play from the start on tons of different systems, you know, and they're just going to play the game like a normal person would and tell me, you know, oh, I ran into this bug or this issue or whatever. And so it's like, I'm going to get kind of the broadest possible bugs out of the way, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah. You're going to get the ones that people run into in regular gameplay. And you're not going to get the ones that the speedrunners will exploit, you know.
Actually, the consistent fans are the speedrunners is the thing.
Oh, okay. Like, so you do have some speedrunners going.
Yeah. Yeah, like, apparently, my game right now, it's actually pretty fun to speedrun, apparently. Like, I have a lot of people, like, who just mess around with the movement mechanics and like try to figure out the fastest way to get through it.
Have you found out about any bugs that your speedrunners have been like, no, don't remove this, please?
There was one where if you like hit like a slope in the ground just right by like shooting yourself backwards with a grenade launcher or doing like a grenade boost backwards into a thing, you would fly like 50 miles straight up.
Whoa.
And so, and they're like, oh, I found this one. You can just skip everything. I was like, okay, yeah, I gotta fix that. It would sometimes happen in normal gameplay. Mostly if you, like, shot an enemy and they got knocked back into a slope, they would just fly up into the air.
I've had so many issues with sending the player flying up into the air, developing my movement system. It's the worst kind of bug. I'm actually facing that right now in the game I'm making that features swimming, where... It's not up into the air, but it's if you hit things at the right angle, the way the Unity character controller handles collision, it will go into the wall slightly, and then on the next frame, it will send you flying off across the room. And so I'm going to have a headache fixing that properly.
Oh, that's annoying. Kind of reminds me, I just saw a tweet that whoever worked on the Skyrim intro was like tweeting about it. They said that apparently the cart was fully physically simulated, and so they had to like... debug a ton of physics issues on that. because like there was like one port where you'd be sitting in the cart and it's like playing the intro, like, hey, you're finally awake, and then a bee would fly into the cart and the bee was like an immovable physical object, so it would just push the cart out of the way. It's like, how do you even debug that?
Sounds like Skyrim.
It's like, oh, that explains a lot of the funny like Skyrim bugs I've seen where the cart just like flips over and stuff. How would you compare like game dev YouTube several years ago to today?
I'm not like super up to date with game dev YouTube, but from what I know, I feel like just everyone who is doing game dev YouTube these days is doing it full time or something, because they all like super high production value. I mean, at least like some of the ones I see. But I don't know, is game dev YouTube like dwindling down a little bit, or is that just a feeling I'm getting?
Definitely ramping up.
One thing I was going to say on the other question we had about YouTube being the key to monetizing is that there's only so many people out there who are interested in watching game development on YouTube. It has to be people who are interested in game development, you know? And so it's almost mostly actual game developers are people who are aspiring game developers watching game dev YouTube. And the audience, well, from what I can guess, the audience only has so much time. They want to work on their own games, and game development isn't really something you can watch YouTube while you're doing, unless it's like level design or art that you're working on.
I don't know about that though. I feel like because you always also like advertise on Twitter, but I would argue that almost all of your following on Twitter are game developers probably. I feel like a big audience on like the game dev YouTube is not people who are interested in making games, but people that like the fantasy of it, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I think it largely depends on how you sculpt your content, really.
Mm-hmm.
I actually used to think that it was mostly like people that are interested in doing it until like Danny showed up, and it's like, whoa, hold on a second, these numbers are possible.
Yeah.
I think it's really about how you deliver the story on what you're working on, because you can fulfill the desire of anyone who's interested in games, which is like most of the population, if you just like tell the story right on whatever update you're working on, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But I get really annoyed when I'm watching a Danny video and he just skims over all the technical stuff.
Fair enough.
I'm like, I need to know. I need to know how badly hung together your code is.
I need something to hold on to, so I'm not just jealous.
I mean, I used to think it was just like for his videos. He does a lot of memes and like, you know, jokes and stuff. And like, I used to think like, oh, well, you know, if people are going to watch game dev stuff and they have that kind of numbers, it's got to be, you know, that kind of presentation. It's got to be lots of jokes and memes. But then like, I think about, you know, I just did a video like a few months ago about how to make a survival horror game. And it's just like very, I mean, it's short to the point, just like focuses on like some design concepts and talks about those and like a few little algorithms. And I like didn't show code. I didn't like talk about that kind of thing. Just like very loosely covered technical details and design stuff. And then 500 million views.
I mean,
hold on a second.
Yeah, and I think that kind of goes into like the whole point is like YouTube has like a lot of like video essay stuff, and I don't really think it has that much to do with whether or not the people that are watching it are interested in that, because you have like the biggest video essays are like on film and like how to make film, but like maybe 5 people make film or something. So
yeah,
and it's definitely the same for game dev. And about the Danny thing, where it's like it skips over the technical stuff, I think a big point of also is like making your audience feel like they're smart and intellectuals, and sometimes going into the technical stuff helps with them, I think.
I mean, and I also think about video essays on like other stuff that I have never had any interest in or knew anything about.
Yeah.
And then I watch it and it's like, this is the greatest thing ever. Like I watched a video on sumo wrestling and I was like, I knew nothing about sumo wrestling. And now I'm like, sumo wrestling is the coolest thing ever. Like I want to watch sumo wrestling.
And
I'm like,
and I think it's funny that like Game Maker Toolkit still says like, so in your game do this, which is funny because I'm sure all the people that watch Game Maker Toolkit do not make games.
Yeah. what I was going to say is that there is a niche that I think has an opening right now. Well, from when I was planning to make YouTube videos like last summer, I had this thought that a lot of the games I follow are like continuously developed games that have big updates on a yearly or twice yearly or whatever basis. Like I play No Man's Sky and Minecraft a lot. And around those releases, there's a lot of speculation. And there's a lot of speculative game design by non-game designers.
Oh, yeah.
But as a game designer, I'm always trying to think of, if I was actually Hello Games, how would I be doing this? Or if I was actually Mojang, how would I be doing this? Not just what's my dream for what could happen.
Uh-huh.
And I actually, like, before the big Caves and Cliffs update that Minecraft is getting right now was announced, I was planning to make a YouTube video basically called how to do the Caves and Cliffs update right or something from a game designer's perspective. I didn't have a solid title in mind, but I guarantee that if I had like made that video, I reckon it would have gotten views and done quite well. At the same time, it's like I don't have the time to do this if I'm making games. But I think if I do make some game development or game design based videos, I would love to make speculative game design videos like that, talking about how you could add on to a game without breaking it.
Jabril, you going to, I guess, what was in the past, like, because you've been around for 3 years about, right, on YouTube, and, like, getting views, you know, on a fair amount of videos, too, during that whole time. What do you think has, like, changed, I guess, from back then to now in terms of, like, what people view and what people want to see?
I think the biggest change that I've seen, so when I started, there were very few game developing channels. There's like Thin Matrix, Sebastian League, Brackies, and that was about the extent of it. And when I started, I seen that, like, okay, there's no one that's really like taking the stuff that Brackies is teaching Sebastian, who was like mostly a tutorial channel at the time. I was like, there's no one that's taking this stuff and applying it and making it fun. So that's why I started my channel. But nowadays, there's so many channels that are doing it, and I think it's fantastic. I think it's great. I think Danny struck a chord when he figured out like how to take it even bigger. Like, I'm talking averaging like millions of views like in the first like 12, 24 hours. Mm. And that's completely shifted. It's changed on how like a lot of game developer channels view the platform now, which is like, I don't know, I think it's kind of inspired like the confidence that like, oh wow, game development, it is a legit like subcategory on YouTube that can compete with some of the biggest channels. And with that, you know, there's pros and cons. You know, one of the biggest cons is that like now the projects are a lot more empty. Like this is my personal opinion, I think they're a bit more like soulless, as far as like, you know, I remade this really popular game but added this one thing to it. I think that the benefit is that like you're reaching a larger audience, you're inspiring more people to get involved and do game development. And it's, I think there's a good trickle down effect of like all these people that are introduced to this field. Now there's more people for like smaller developers to then feed off of, you know.
I think it's also interesting because like the way like Danny is doing it and like striking a bit bigger audience, I wonder if that's going to have like, on the long term, a bigger effect on like who's gonna try and start making games and stuff, maybe.
Yeah, and if people are gonna start seeing as like, you know, I made Among Us 3D, is like, that's a good way to, you know, like get views and stuff. Because I mean, that's kind of what I did, was I saw 98 Demake doing PS1 Demakes, and I was like, I could get views doing that probably. So I tried it and I did, and that was like what kickstarted my channel in the first, like, got me to like 10k.
Yeah, I've actually seen a few YouTube channels that are definitely taking interest or taking inspiration from how Danny approaches things. The thing I've noticed is that not a lot of them are actually releasing games. They're making prototypes or whatever. And that's fine. And maybe some of them are releasing them, but they are more like prototype stage of development things. And I think especially when you go with like the Among Us bit VR or whatever, it's something that you can't really bring to completion unless you put in a bunch of work redirecting it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the only devs I feel like on, I feel like from, you know, except humans, but from like the game dev YouTube space that are like doing, like they're doing like a full length game that's taking them like years to make, but they're like filling in time to do content, is probably like Jonas Tiroli.
Mm. Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, damn, he is the only other one.
Yeah, I guess the question becomes like, well, why is that like an important part to like important part of the tradition when it comes to game development?
Yeah,
that's a yeah. I guess it's scale of the game, and it's also just like the market. I still think that the reality of it is that a lot of people on Steam don't buy a game if it's under 2 hours, and you're gonna probably spend like a year on it if you want it to be above 2 hours. Probably.
Yeah.
All right. Hold on. I just want to dig into this a bit. So, the focus there was on the money aspect. So, what if I were to say that, although this is true, if you can make 10x the amount of money that you would make on a long form project, making a video about a thing, how does that change your opinion on the approach?
You mean that you could make more money, like making shorter games or like making games for YouTubers?
By monetizing it via YouTube ads.
That's a good point. And I think, like, personally, because I like doing small games, I would, like, totally be up for them. I don't know. It's, I still think, like, a lot of people, the dream is getting big on Steam, you know?
What I would say is, the question isn't, why is the focus on finishing a game or making a big game?
Mm.
The question is, why do we make games? Because, like, if you're only making games for attention, then sure, go and make a bunch of YouTube videos about it. Or if you're making games to experiment, then you can do YouTube videos about it. But if you want to make games as, like, as an artistic outlet or as a storytelling outlet, you really do have to just put in the time and make something longer, because otherwise you're going to find yourself constrained in what you can actually do. Which is something I've been facing recently as I've been moving towards longer form games and thinking about something that could potentially take over a year to make.
And I'm sure it's possible to do that with YouTube, but I feel like, especially if you want to do like narrative stuff, you know, and you want to strike like an emotional chord, like on that end, I think it's really hard to make like YouTube content around the development of that without like kind of ruining the story a little bit. In the process, I don't know.
I've actually seen this recently with I don't know if you know Yahtzee Croshaw's Dev Diary series. He's the guy who does zero punctuation. But recently, he's been working on the characters for his game, and he has like 8 main non-player characters, and he has to write the dialogue between every character and the player. He doesn't have anything to make videos about, like, or well. He doesn't really, so he's ended up having to work out other things to fill the videos up with.
Yeah, I wonder if like his game, like his ultimately, like his game will have like an effect on them, because I feel like the biggest part of his games that he has made is like it's all like narrative and like just talking, you know.
There was something else I was thinking about with regards to this recently. A friend of mine is making a game, an RPG maker, and they're trying to promoted on Twitter, and they were basically saying this is the last spoiler-free promotional post we can make, and they're like months out from release, so there's like this big gap of time that they have no marketing content to fill, like no development-based marketing content to fill.
Yeah, I don't know. I do agree to a certain extent about the narrative, like narrative games being hard to market, but I think that there's always a way. It's just like really, really difficult. And I think a really good example is Disco Elysium, I think is the name of the game, where that's a hugely narrative game, but their marketing strategy was genius. They basically just took a bunch of like various memes and like modeled the sequence in their game and released that on their, and like that was genius, because I figured out the game through that. And I was interested in this game because, you know, for me as a developer, I like understood the intention of that developer, and I became like a mega fan. So I think there's always a way. It's just a matter of like, you cannot stop looking for what it is to market your game.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely a challenge, though. That's probably the reason why most people don't do it.
This other kind of dialogue-heavy game, I think it's a story-focused game, but I see posts from them on Twitter a fair amount, and like they'll just show like a little clip where you walk up to a character and they'll say something funny, like one line, and it's just like, that's it. And it's just like, that's always like, you know, if you just toss in like a one-line joke or something in one area, that's always something you can post, right? As like a quick marketing thing. It definitely is like the tradition, I feel like, that you spend years making something. And I think that is breaking. Yeah, it's like people like you and stuff do more month games, and I'm going to start doing that also when I'm done.
I think it's like an interesting point is also like I want to look up like games made by like full-time YouTube people, you know, but it's like there are so little like game dev YouTubers that actually finish their games. And I'm wondering if that has something to do with that. I don't know.
I can answer. You start making game dev content, you realize like you can make a bunch of money if you just, you know, do a slight deviation to making this type of content.
And it's also, I feel like it's just game dev YouTube is pretty young. So a lot of people are making it, started their games just like a year or two ago. And so they, of course, they're not done yet because of that, because it just started.
I do think, as I was saying, I think there's a lot of room for not game dev YouTube, but more game design YouTube. Like I was saying, like the speculative stuff, but also just more stuff like what Game Maker's Toolkit does, applied to obviously different games and genres and everything. But I think if I do end up starting making YouTube, which I keep promising myself I will because I really want to, but I would try and blend that in with my game dev, like get into the weeds of some game design topics that are less commonly talked about.
The time to start is now, you know, before it gets more crowded, the tools get easier and...
Yeah. I mean, I've just got to find a time.
So, I miss the Newgrounds era. I don't know if you guys were able to participate in this era or not. It was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever. But I miss the Newgrounds era. Was so bad. Because it was just like the most raw game dev experiences you can imagine. Mm. And I don't know, there's something about the community aspect of it that was just like, it was just mwah, chef's kiss. Mm-hmm. I miss that so much.
Yeah.
And then you have like the modern day game dev era, which is mixed in with like various social media. And I think it's kind of like splintered and like there's a huge focus on making a lot of money. So I guess my question is kind of like, taking in consideration what I just said, what aspects of like traditional game dev do you feel is important to conserve moving forward into the future?
Okay, I want to start by saying I think you're not the only one that's missing the Newgrounds days. If you look at the games that's being made today, like if you look at Among Us and Friday Night Funkin', it's basically just Newgrounds games.
Mm, yes.
But also, I think a big part of the Newgrounds era is that all of the biggest chunk of the people making games there were 16 and like 14, I think.
Yeah, just in school.
And that's probably like a big reason why like the it's not that it didn't have like that money thing going on, I think.
The other key element is of course Flash, which there's nothing right now that works quite like Flash does. In that you could edit your code, draw your pictures, animate everything, do like most features that you needed to add, you didn't have to leave the engine for, especially because it was limited to like 2D. And one of this biggest time sinks I find nowadays is switching back and forth between different editors, rearranging your brain for a different workflow in a different editor and different keyboard shortcuts. And so actually an all-in-one tool like that does make it more accessible for people.
Yeah, that's a great point.
But I would argue that itch is basically the new Newgrounds, and it's just like the community has moved from forums to Discords. But there's still a lot of collaboration happening. Maybe not in exactly the same vein, just because of the whole Flash thing. I would say like the core of the universe of the Newgrounds thing, which is the community, is still alive. It's just different, and it's probably one of those things that's going to be really apparent like 10 years from now. Like, oh, I miss the itch.io days.
I mean, even today, I was thinking about like what it must have been like to be a game developer in the '90s, in like the late 90s working on a project like, so there were so many more short development cycle projects by like highly funded developers at that point. So many cool games came out of that era. It's definitely something I like think about a lot as like running the home to PS1 and everything.
I think that's coming back though, like a large part of that, because of the subscription model stuff. I think smaller games will be profitable again.
I also think just like in the indie space, more stuff like that is being funded. I'm not sure if publishers, like indie publishers, are gonna keep being a thing, but they definitely like fill that niche. But the problem there is that I think a lot of the developers have less stability than the developers in the 90s might have had. Although, then again, there was some pretty rocky times back then, from what I've heard.
If I can add on to this conversation, I think you're right. I remember that when I was making games, and I was a part of a community that also made like little indie games, the last thing on our mind was the profit off of what we were making. Because there was no distribution. It was, you make an EXE or you make a Flash game. I mean, I guess Flash, there was distribution with Newgrounds and stuff like that. But I'd make Game Maker games and there was no distribution. So it's like, we're making this thing because we want to make it.
Yeah.
And I think that when you fast forward to today and how big the gaming industry is today, I think that is a component that you can never get back. Because the industry is so huge, there's so many suits that are looking to take advantage of even like the smallest projects.
I disagree though, like on a large part of that, because still lots of people getting into game development are still just doing it just as a hobby thing. It's just like at a certain point you start, when you get like enough audience, it starts becoming one thing, I think, for a lot of people. And the same like during the Flash times, because like a lot of those Flash games were monetized with like ads and stuff, and you had like the whole like armor game stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
So it's about like moving from like hobbyists to like doing it more seriously. And I still think that's kind of happening in the same vein-ish as the Newgrounds says.
I think a lot of those games that like were not profit things, nowadays they get made for game jams a lot of the time, which is like, I've made so many free games for game jams in the last 8 years. I've only made like one commercial game. I've helped make another one, but I've released one of my own personal games in a commercial capacity only once.
So it's just reminding me of, I read this book, Hackers, by Stephen Levy, about like computer hackers, right? Like the old school, like back in the universities when they had the giant computers and they would just program for fun, and it was like this addiction for them. They would just program all day and night, and it was like the funnest thing ever. And then after a while, as computers, personal computers started coming out, and people started getting computers in their homes, kids would, you know, learn how to program and they'd get addicted to it and they'd start hacking, you know, their own programs. And then people would start selling their programs and making money, and suddenly people were like, oh, you can make money off of this. And we're like, and then it suddenly became like, now you can make money selling computer programs. And there's all these like former university students who were like, this isn't right. We should just be programming for fun and sharing everything we make for free. And like those people are still around today even. And they're just like, you know, it's such a shame that everything went corporate, you know, and that, you know, now it's like expected to make money off your computer programs and you don't just do it for fun anymore. And that's just, you know, it's kind of reminding me of what you're saying with the Newgrounds stuff.
All art would be better if we didn't have to think about money.
But I also think generally it is a good thing that a platform like Itch is so keen on helping you out with monetizing your stuff and like giving you all of that freedom, compared to like Newgrounds, where you had to talk to like Armor Game suits to get your game monetized or something.
Also, one thing, just comparing the culture of like Newgrounds to Itch, I feel like it's just kind of everyone grew up, has a job and like has to think about that in spare time and stuff like that, whereas back then everyone was teenagers and probably edgy in different ways. I just feel like it's the Newgrounds squad grew up, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you look at those old Edmund McMillan games.
Oh yeah.
I'm not as deep into like the indie dev scene as I wish I was, but I feel like most game developers nowadays know that there is a chance that they can make like a lot of money if they make the right game.
Yeah.
And I don't think that same sentiment was like very popular, at least back when I was making games back in the days. And I think that that like awareness changes the type of experiences that you're willing to make, like maybe not like completely, but to a certain degree. And I think like that aspect is something that we'll never be able to get back. But
I think the closest you could get with that would actually be like modding, because there are people who make things without money in mind because it's just a mod, but they're doing some actual game design and making interesting things. I mean, even like, especially like Minecraft or something, where people make entirely new game modes and stuff off of Minecraft.
I was just going to mention one case that I know that's happening right now, where someone's making a game and they're explicitly stating this is not a monetary thing, and people keep asking them, but how are you going to make money off of it? Is a dev is making a PlayStation 1 styled remake or demake of Bloodborne. That's really interesting, because that's something that you can't monetize anyway, and it's really cool. And so there is still room for that, but the thing is always that person has to have a source of income somewhere else. Unless you're a teenager like most people, making games on Newgrounds were for a long time. In the modern world, you don't have that opportunity.
My counter would be that that developer is making a remake of a game which serves as their marketing. When what I'm talking about is like, there's this game that I love. It's a game maker game called Untitled Story. But like it's a very original, unique story that like you can't get anywhere else but this game. They weren't looking to make money. They weren't looking to do anything. They just wanted to make this game.
Realistically, I wish I didn't have to think about money, but it sucks that I do. And right now I'm in a, like a very businessy mindset, because I'm trying to get to a point where I can work for myself as a game developer, not be just losing money.
I understand. I know exactly what you're going through.
Oh, Untitled Story is by the devs of Celeste.
Oh, I didn't know that. I have no idea, actually.
It's on their website. Matt Makes Games.
Oh, wow.
Celeste, and then you scroll down and there's Untitled Story.
I never knew that. That's crazy. Yeah. Dude, that game's amazing though. That game is amazing.
The other side of this is there is a small, well, I don't know how small it is, but there is some degree of like a movement in since I'd say 2010 or so, where people view games as art and create installation games and create games as in a way that fits into the traditional art world. And I mean, that's still thinking about money in a different way, because you still need to like the traditional art world has some pretty weird monetization stuff. It is another way to go about it, and it is another perspective on this whole thing where people set out to make a game as a piece of art.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when it's all said and done, like, I'm obviously arguing, like, a fantasy world because, you know, we all need money to survive. And if it were the case for, like, every game was made without the focus of money, there would be no game developer over the age of, like, 17.
I think it's also just generally, you know, we're growing up and I don't know how old you are, but definitely, like, for me, it's just I'm growing up and it's, like, your mind shifts to, like, how do I support myself? And maybe that's just a bigger part of it.
The best thing you can really do is try and make money on your game so you can support people who are making money, or who are making games in the spirit of what you believe in, you know? Like, there are still developers working on projects out there that have that same spirit to them. You kind of just have to key in and find them and support them on Patreon or buy their games or whatever. And it sucks that it can't just be free, but it is a unfortunate reality.
All right, thanks for coming on. This was really interesting.
Yeah, this is fun. I had a lot of fun. Great discussions. It's a pleasure.
Anything you want to promote, Jabrils?
I guess just check out my YouTube channel. From there, you'll find a bunch of various links to the too many things I'm working on. youtube.com/c/Jabrils.